be more vulnerable, whether it's a seasonal flu or it's a dengue flu or it is a hemorrhagic thrombotic Ebola virus or there could be another strain. So then looking at the pre-existing viral condition is something that we should do. Well, Ebola virus just gives me a reason to bring the subject up. Ebola virus gave me a reason to look into this issue at a deeper level and try to summarize this information and try to call out something meaningful that people can do, reasonable people can do, to strengthen themselves from within. So this is the short message of this program today. This has been Science, Health, and Healing. Please consider becoming BAI friends. Just go to www.wbai.org. Own a piece of this radio station, this voice of courage that I call. This has been Science, Health, and Healing, and I'm your host, Majid Ali. Thank you for joining me, and good night.
A 10-day trip to South Africa, Zimbabwe, and Botswana, starting from December 4th to December 14th. The 10-day trip itinerary includes visits of Soweto, South Africa's biggest township, and Robben Island, where Nelson Mandela was imprisoned. Enjoy breathtaking sightseeing tours of Zimbabwe, including the Victoria Falls, one of the seven natural wonders of the world. The tour will climax in Botswana with a two-day experience of Africa's finest wildlife game reserve at Chobe Safari Lodge, situated in Kasani. For payment deadlines and more information, call Nideli at Easy Tours, 914-934-2116. October 3rd is the deadline for payments. Partial proceeds from the tour will benefit WBAI.
On Sunday, August 17th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl presents poet, writer, commentator, and activist Nikki Giovanni. Join us as we discuss moments in her career and her latest novel, Chasing Utopia. That's Sunday, August 17th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
Hello, I'm Tony Ryan, host of Soul Central Station. Join me this Saturday night as I feature rhythm and blues recording artist Shaka Khan. I'll be taking your Shaka Khan song request, and I'll be giving away tickets for her upcoming concert on August 23rd at the Hammerstein Ballroom. So join me this Saturday night on Soul Central Station starting at 10 p.m. on WBAI New York 99.5 FM.
Well, thank you, Mr. Ryan. I'll be sure to tune in. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming live at WBAI.org. It is midnight, coming up in 90 minutes, Jim Freund with Hour of the Wolf. But right now, in its regular time slot, a special commemorative edition of Earthwatch with Robert Knight. Stay tuned.
On today's Earthwatch, we start with the Contragate program of March 4, 1988, in which Robert Knight and Dennis Bernstein speak about the U.S. destabilization and subversive activities in Central America, including support for the Contras in Panama. It includes a report by investigative journalist Alan Nairn about the Israeli occupation in West Bank of Palestine that gives insight and depth to the understanding of events taking place today. Alan also covers U.S. arms deals with Iran and within Central America. In the second segment, also from Contragate of March 1988, we hear a discussion between Robert Knight and correspondent Martha Honey about the political situation in Panama and her experiences during a general strike. Following is a report by correspondent Sally O'Brien on hearings of the Christic Institute lawsuit that revealed covert operations conducted by U.S. operatives. The Christic Institute was a public interest law firm founded in 1980 and most famously uncovered the Iran-Contra affair and led the lawsuit at the heart of the scandal. In the third segment, we move forward in time to an Earthwatch broadcast in 1992 in which Robert Knight interviews Philip Agee, former Central Intelligence agent and author of the book Inside the Company, CIA Diary, detailing his experience in the CIA. We pick up the interview as Philip Agee describes the overthrow of Marcos in the Philippines and describes how the same tactics were used in Panama, Nicaragua, Ecuador, and Colombia. He goes on to speak of how the CIA has worked to bust the trade unions in the United States and goes on with a discussion on the subversion of democracy, free trade agreements, and the National Endowments for Democracy. They are joined by the late Stuart Hutchison of WBAI Pacifica and NPR, who produced and hosted the three-hour public affairs special program, Philip Agee, on the CIA and covert action. The segment concludes with a series of very astute listener phone calls.
Next up is Earthwatch.
Still rings, the bell for freedom still rings. Sorrow to me, but does it ring to know the bell of freedom still rings? The hammer for justice still pounds, the hammer for justice still pounds. Heavy is the beating justice that pounds. When will the world stop and listen? When will we all stop and see? Know that millions of babies still starve. Millions of babies still starve. We can't have the biggest heart if millions of babies still starve. And the innocent ones still die. The innocent ones still die. We can't value life too high if the innocent ones still die. When will the world stop and listen? When will we all stop and see? Upon us with a frown. Light of truth we won't let shine. Light of truth we won't let shine. Tell me, has the world gone blind? Light of truth we won't let shine. There's still a day, and I know that we can find our way. For as long as there's life, there's still a day.
I'm Robert Knight with Dennis Bernstein in New York, and this is ContraGate. Have with us in the studio Alan Naron. Alan Naron is the author of a very fine piece in last week's Village Voice, and also a piece in this week's this month's Progressive about the connections between Donald Gregg and the illegal arms network.
That also in today's program, we'll be hearing an interview with Christic Institute Executive Director Sarah Nelson on the depositions and the current progress of the suit on behalf of Tony Avergan and Martha Honey in regard to the La Pinca bombing and the suit against some 27 members of the secret team that has been operating in covert policy in Central America and elsewhere throughout the world. We begin by noting the crisis in Panama. There are two developments there. Number one, talk continues about the imposition of sanctions in among congressional and executive leadership in the United States, but there has been a breakdown in the general strike that's been called against the government of Nicaragua. The opposition Civic Crusade is calling it off, claiming that it was a success, but supporters of the current Panamanian government say that it is being called off because it was incompletely successful. Meanwhile, we have learned that in the Civic Crusade, there is a major split emerging in which some members who may have aligned with the predominantly middle-class white business leadership of that opposition group are involved in a split because they do not want possibly to be identified so thoroughly with United States interests and the support of Del Valle in an operation that looks very thoroughly as if it were made in the USA. The nation of Panama is going to endure a great amount of suffering as a result of the economic restrictions that have been imposed so far, that is to say in regard to the transfer of banking monies, the cutoff of U.S. military and economic aid, and the cutting by three-quarters of sugar quotas and other forms of economic aid. And you, Dennis, were speaking about the further comparisons that could be made, not in an internal restrictions sense necessarily, but in terms of the overthrow of Chile, where Henry Kissinger said that his goal was to make the economy scream.
Indeed, and we are seeing a situation in which it is a classic case of destabilization, and it playing its proper part, apparently, are the major mainstream media. In today's New York Times, the disinformation campaign continues unchecked. Listen to this sentence, which is totally untrue. The Times, in a front-page story talking about Panama and what support it has in the world community or doesn't have, the sentence reads, on Tuesday, Eric Arturo Del Valle, who was recognized as Panama's president by the United States and most other nations. It's not true. In Europe, there is substantial support for Noriega and for the duly constituted processes in Panama that have been not probably put in place as a democracy, but have been operating over the last 10, 15, 20 years.
In point of fact, the leader of Panama at the moment is Manuel Solis Palma, who is the president, or to be precise in terms of Panamanian constitutional terms, the caretaker of the presidency of the republic. Del Valle was removed by the national legislature, and Solis Palma was appointed by the cabinet, as is prescribed, in a military-dominated situation that was groomed in large part by the United States over the years from the transition from the National Guard to the Panamanian Defense Forces.
So we continue with the New York Times, and the story is here that the United States is following the lead of the Panama opposition. That's what the story here says on page A7 of the Times. U.S. is said to take Noriega foe's cue. And they suggest that this is something indigenous in Panama, and the United States is going along. In the same article, in fact, in the third paragraph, they say, oh, and by the way, this movement is being led by William D. Rogers and other attorneys who work with international lawyers and from the United States. William D. Rogers, a former State Department official, is leading this so-called charge that's being led by Del Valle.
The characterization of the United States following the lead of the opposition is entirely the opposite of the fact. In fact, former President Del Valle met with Elliot Abrams, Undersecretary of State for Inter-American Affairs, on the 17th of February, just a week before his call for the resignation of Noriega. He met also in New York City with William Walker, another Undersecretary of State, who asked him directly, why do you not fire Noriega? And at the same time, José Blandón had been meeting with opposition leaders in Miami in order to arrange a concerted push against the leadership of General Noriega.
Schultz said in Europe yesterday that the United States is, quote, seeking ways to restrict the flow of money into the treasury of Panama. Is that the State Department of the United States stating a policy? Let's continue with today's program.
In other policy, a major event has taken place in the House of Representatives, in which the Democratic Party and some members of the Republican Party, quite opposite to expectations, declined to pass a measure designed by Jim Wright to provide additional aid to the Contras. The plan had been to vote for the appending of a Democratic aid proposal to a Republican proposal, and then to enact another vote to then actually pass the Democratic measure. The plan went according to plan on the first vote, and then in the second vote, a number of legislators went against the bill, and as a result, the Democratic Party Contra aid proposal was defeated by a vote of 216 to 208. And it is worth noting that in New York, virtually every Democratic Party representative voted for the Contra aid plan.
For $30 million more in Contra aid. Well, it's also an interesting situation.
Only exception being Representative Stratton.
Okay. Well, however it happened, it apparently might help the situation in Central America. It might help real peace talks continue. Now, we continue with Alan Naron, who is an investigative journalist who has reported for just about everybody. He has he had a recent story in actually last week's Village Voice about the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza by the Israelis, and he is here in our studio to talk about what he saw on his recent visit to the West Bank. Good morning, Alan.
Morning.
Thanks for joining us. I'd like to first ask you, we've heard a lot about this Iron Fist policy, and as if it beatings and so on and so forth are a new policy. I wonder if you could sort of give us a bit of the history. Is Iron Fist and beatings new? All right.
No, it's a tactic that the Israeli army has used for years. It's also the demonstrations on the part of the Palestinians are also not new. From 1967 until last year, the Israeli government recorded more than 17,000 incidents of what they call disturbances of the peace, which include things like demonstrations, rock throwing, tire burnings, hoistings of the Palestinian flag, etc. The government has over the years responded to these actions by the Palestinians with great force. More than 90 Palestinian civilians were shot by Israeli troops between 1967 and 1983. And the actual phrase Iron Fist first became well known in Israel in 1982. In that year, the Israeli military government that rules the West Bank fired the elected Palestinian mayors of Nablus, Ramallah, and Al-Bira, three of the principal towns there. And the Palestinians responded with a wave of demonstrations and strikes. And the Israeli army responded to these demonstrations in exactly the same way they've responded in the recent months. They fired into crowds. In one 2-month period, 10 Palestinians were killed. And the military commander of the West Bank, Colonel Yaakov Hartabi, issued explicit orders to his troops to, well, this is a quote from the orders he issued. They were to assemble passersby or people outside their homes in order to beat them up. Army Chief of Staff, General Rafael Eitan, later testified that he himself issued orders that parents were to be punished for the actions of their children. If children were throwing stones, the parents were to be punished, and that village elders were also to be punished if there were protests in their villages. And there was a series of beatings and deliberately inflicted injuries of Palestinians. Now, after these demonstrations in 1983, an Israeli military court convicted four officers of abuses, and they rebuked Hartabi for having ordered the beatings. The only real change now from 1982 is that the same tactics that Hartabi was criticized for after the fact have now been openly embraced by the government political leadership. Prime Minister Shamir has called openly in the Knesset for a policy of beatings and has said, we have to put the fear of death into Palestinians. So this is just a continuation of tactics that have been used before. The other difference is that in the past these tactics worked. They did succeed eventually in quelling the Palestinian protests. Now the protests seem to have achieved a kind of critical mass, and every violent action taken by the Israeli army only seems to make things hotter.
Alan Naron, I wonder if you could talk a bit more precisely about the attitude of the army, perhaps anecdotally, of the army toward the West Bankers.
It was, although you hear a great deal in the American press about the agony of the Israeli troops as they're forced to perform the chores of occupation, that's not really evident when you're there on the scene observing the troops in action. It looks very similar to other scenes of occupation armies that you would see in, say, the countryside of Guatemala or El Salvador, where you have an army that's ruling by force and a population that's completely hostile to them. The troops all carry clubs. Many times after beating people, you'll see them walking around spinning the clubs on a string. When you ask them about what they're doing, they speak with pride and enthusiasm. There was one case I saw where, as soldiers were arresting a teenage boy, a group of women came running up, shouting at the soldiers, trying to stop it. The soldiers yelled back at the women. They wouldn't go away. One of the women grabbed a soldier. The soldier hit her with his club, and it touched off a riot in the square, where there was fighting for about 10 minutes between the soldiers and mainly women. And soldiers were beating women with clubs and rifle butts. People were throwing vegetables at the soldiers and their jeeps. The soldiers finally broke it up by firing tear gas into the crowd. But throughout this, the soldiers showed no reluctance in beating women. And afterwards, in asking the soldiers about it, they said, well, the women were beating us. What are we supposed to do? We have to beat them when they beat us. Right after this particular confrontation, the soldiers went on a rampage, just running down the streets, breaking the windows of stores, breaking into shops owned by Palestinian shopkeepers, smashing the display cases, smashing glassware inside, for no particular reason. There wasn't any provocation on the part of the store owners. They were just venting their anger and their enthusiasm.
Alan, there's one extraordinary story that you tell in this Village Voice piece published last week about a situation in which Israeli soldiers go into a particular house and attempt to arrest a five-year-old.
This was in the Jelazon refugee camp. Tires were burning outside. The soldiers came into the house and asked the mother to present her children, because they said they assumed that they had set the fires. The only child in the house was a five-year-old, so the soldiers took that child. The mother ran after, trying to get the child back, and eventually, as she was trying to do that, she was shot in the hand and in the knee.
For trying to retrieve her five-year-old child?
Yes.
And what was the precise justification for taking this five-year-old?
Because tires were burning outside, and the Army routinely picks people up off the streets and detains them without making a formal arrest, and it often makes the children clean up the stones in the streets, and sometimes we'll beat them.
Would you say the arrest of this five-year-old is an aberration, or rather typical?
It seems fairly typical. We saw quite a few children. I mean, that's very young. You don't usually find a child that young, but so many scenes of children who looked like they were maybe 8, 10, 12 being taken by the soldiers and made to clean up the streets, or take down a Palestinian flag that was flying over a mosque, or things of the sort.
You're listening to ContraGate on WBAI in New York. Our guest today is investigative journalist Alan Naron. And Alan, I want to ask you now about the this notion of infighting within the West Bank and within the community within the West Bank. We are beginning to see reports, like in yesterday's New York Times, that the problem is beginning to be Palestinian against Palestinian. They're beginning to kill each other, and that it almost suggested that the Israelis were there also to help them stop from killing each other. What about unity? How did you find? Are people unified in the West Bank? Are Palestinians unified?
There seems to be more unity among the Palestinians than in any other resistance or revolutionary, than in any other resistance or revolutionary movement I've ever seen in Central America, for example. It really cuts across class lines among the Palestinians. When it comes to collaborators, those who've been collaborating with the Israeli military or who are suspected of that, yes, the Palestinians will take action against them and in some cases kill them. There's a very clear line between those who are seen as collaborating with the Israelis and the rest of the population. As far as the rest of the Palestinians, though, there seems to be a remarkable unity. There's some talk here of how the emergence of a new leadership in the occupied territories during the protests, how that somehow endangers the leadership of the PLO and represents a significant split within the Palestinians. In talking to Palestinians there, though, you don't see much evidence of that. Yes, leaders have emerged during the protests, but their goals are no different from those of the PLO, and will all state their own allegiance to the PLO. This could result in the long term in some political changes within the PLO, but none that will affect their posture vis-a-vis Israel. If anything, the Palestinians seem to be more united and more vigorous now in calling for an end to the occupation.
Okay, well, that's a bit of your story on the West Bank. I urge people, if they're interested in getting more of the details, that they go to the library or wherever they can and pick up the March 1st, 1988 issue of The Village Voice and read Alan Naron's well-written story about his visit to the West Bank. I want to take you to another place, Alan. I want to take you back to Central America, where you've done such good reporting from. And I want to talk to you about a new story that you have, or a recent story in the Progressive. I think it's the March issue. Yes.
Yes.
And this is, once again, you're pursuing the Bush connection in Contragate, and the connection precisely between Bush's National Security Advisor Donald Gregg and the illegal arms supply network that was operating under Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North. Why don't you now tell us a little bit about the connection between Gregg and Richard Brennecke?
Brennecke is a businessman and arms dealer from Portland, Oregon, who was extensively involved in arms sales to Iran. He wrote a series of memos on U.S. arms sales to Iran that were disclosed in a federal court case here in 1986. And these memos, which were written 10 months before the Iran arms scandal became public, indicated that Brennecke had detailed inside knowledge of the whole arms for hostages swap. He talked about Poindexter authorizing the sale of TOW missiles. He talked about many details that only became public 10 months later. So these memos established the fact that Brennecke had an inside track on the whole Iran-Contra arms deal. Several weeks ago, Brennecke told me, after a series of interviews, that he was also involved in some arms deals with the Contras. And he said that in these deals, which took place in 1985 and 1986, he worked with Donald Gregg, who is Vice President Bush's National Security Advisor. He said that Gregg served as a clearinghouse for these arms deals. Gregg would give information on Contra buyers, on banks, on arms suppliers. Brennecke says he had about a dozen phone conversations with Gregg, that Gregg asked to be kept informed of all the details, that Gregg would give him information on how to proceed with logistics, with arrangements for arms drops and so on. Brennecke says that some of the specific deals Gregg was involved in included sales of Czechoslovakian-made AK-47 rifles to the Contras. Brennecke says that he personally obtained the rifles from Omnipol, the Czech arms manufacturing company, and that Gregg gave information and advice on brokering the deals and making arrangements with European backers, and also obtaining false end-user certificates, which the end-user certificates indicated that these AK-47s were bound for the governments of Bolivia, Paraguay, and Panama, when in fact they were bound for the Contras, according to Brennecke.
Alan Naron, if you could sum up explaining where Gregg first comes into this illegal supply operation and sort of explain how the Brennecke sort of fits into the old information, if you will.
Gregg is the vice president's main national security advisor, and there have been a series of disclosures over the past year which indicate that Gregg was heavily involved in providing covert military aid to the Contras. Gregg sent Felix Rodriguez, a former colleague of his from the CIA, to the Ilopango Air Base in El Salvador, where Rodriguez, it later came out, coordinated the Contra Air resupply operation. Gregg also sent, prior to Rodriguez, Gregg sent another former CIA agent named Gustavo Violdo to Honduras, where Violdo served as a military trainer for the Contras. There is an entry in Oliver North's notebooks talking about a September 10th, 1986 meeting among North, Donald Gregg, and Colonel Steele, who was the U.S. military attaché in El Salvador. North's notes indicate that the topic at that meeting was the Ilopango air base and its use in Contra resupply. And North's notes say that Gregg actively participated in that discussion. Gregg has denied in testimony before the Iran-Contra Committee and in an interview with me and in many other places that he had anything to do with Contra aid, and Bush has denied that as well.
Okay, well, that gives us an update, and it sort of helps us begin to fit the puzzle together about George Bush and his perhaps connection through his NSC advisor, Donald Gregg, to the Iran illegal Contra supply network in Ilopango Airport.
And that concludes today's edition of ContraGate. I'm Robert Knight in New York with Dennis Bernstein. Our guest has been Alan Nairn. This has been ContraGate for Friday, the 4th of March, 1988. ContraGate can be heard at 8 a.m. on WBAI New York and at 7:15 p.m. and at 5:40 on KPFA in San Francisco. ContraGate is produced by Dennis Bernstein, Robert Knight, Sally O'Brien, Jessica Gigi, Paul DiRienzo, Peter Schinkel in Washington, and Connie Blitt in San Francisco.
Fraudulently re-elected himself. Then they ally themselves with the Catholic Church, and then comes people power, Marcus is overthrown, Cory Aquino goes in, and so forth and so on. So the next year, 87, this man Barria from Panama goes over to study the operation of Namfrel in order to establish a Panamanian version, right? And so he comes back in June of 1987, just as Diaz Herrera is going public against, that's Noriega's number two man, going public against Noriega, and so forth and so on. There are demonstrations in the streets and so forth, and within 2 weeks or 3 weeks, this Panamanian version, which is called Cruzada Civica, or Civic Crusade, has 128 organizations as members, right?
Yes, that's what we saw on television all of the time during the turmoil. The 90% who were opposed to the PRD and Noriega and such, or should we say the 90% of the 10% Euro business class of Panama.
Yes, yes, and as a matter of fact, they then repeat the whole thing in Nicaragua. And there it's called Via Civica, which people in Nicaragua called CIA Civica, you know, for CIA. Because it's amazing how they, and in fact, we had the same thing in Ecuador when I was there. There was another version in Colombia. It was a tactic created all over to unify the bourgeoisie, basically, as a political force, and to give them all the money they needed in order to be a political factor, more so than they might have been otherwise. But in Panama, it's quite interesting to see how they... As a matter of fact, also important, or interesting in, to me anyway, is that when Noriega had found refuge in the residence of the papal nuncio in Panama, it was this same Cruzada Civica who were out in the streets playing that music, you know, and threatening to lynch him, and thereby inducing him to give himself up to the U.S. forces. That was, again, the very same force established by the agency as a copy of what they'd done from the 50s on in the Philippines. So when you follow these things through the years, you see that the techniques don't change that much. And it's easy to spot these different things when you, let's say, study the realities. And the same thing happened in Jamaica in the 70s. I mean, I could go on forever about these things.
Pattern recognition. That's why I'm so happy to see you. So the Panama Deception has is narrated by Elizabeth Montgomery, music by Jackson Brown, Ismael Rivera, Sting, and George Strunz, Jorge Strunz.
And call the Village East. Go see it soon. And you're going to be where tomorrow, Phil?
Robert, I'm going to be at a forum on trade unions. It is a forum to discuss the ways in which the courts in the United States, the police, and the CIA included, have been involved in union busting in the United States. And this is extremely important because of the positive role that trade unions ought to be playing in the U.S. economy and are not, because of things we're going to discuss tomorrow night. It's going to be at the International Action Center, and we'll be there discussing various people, not just I alone, how the U.S. government, the police, the courts, and so forth, and the CIA have been working to undermine the trade union movement through penetration and manipulation of the union movement. I was involved in these operations intensively in Latin America in the 1960s, and I could go on all night about trade union operations, but we'll be able to discuss them tomorrow night with all the people who are interested.
It's another revelation. This is Earthwatch. My name's Robert Knight. We'll be back with more. That's Spy in the House of Love by Was Not Was. And this is Earthwatch. I'm Robert Knight. And speaking with Phil Agee, and we seem to have hit something very useful. In fact, anticipating one of the questions I had for you about filling the military intelligence vacuum in the absence of a coordinated Soviet monster as a basis for arms buildups and covert operations, and maintenance of this hemisphere and the subversion of democracy in what would be independent nations seems, from your discussion before, to be very much near, at the top of the agenda. How does that democratic phenomenon, democratic labor and economic phenomenon in this hemisphere, mesh then with the free trade agreement, as it is called, the hemispheric agreement that the Bush administration and probably the Clinton administration has been pushing?
Yeah, it looks like it, doesn't it? It looks like that Clinton may well go along with this, and it's an open door for capital, basically, to flee this country and go into Mexico, or flee Canada and go into Mexico. And there, take advantage of the low wages, you know, the inability really to control the ecological protections and so forth. And it's an unfortunate thing, really, that many jobs in this country will be lost. There is the argument made constantly, you know, that it's going to create new jobs as well. But that remains to be seen. What really is going to happen, I think, it's certainly at the beginning, is that many of the jobs of people here in the United States will be lost. But that makes Mexico all the more important for the United States in terms of stability and in terms of keeping the system going as it is. I think many listeners will know that Mexico has been ruled by the very same party since the 1920s, and they have not allowed any real opposition to develop. They've rigged elections time after time after time, and it seems now that they are beginning to open the door for the conservatives, the PAN, to become the opposition party and to keep down the PRD, I believe it's called, that's Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas Party, which is progressive, left-wing, keep them out of the political process as far as they can keep them. That means that the CIA is going to be all the more concerned about Mexico, and even when I was there in the CIA in Mexico, Mexico was the most important country in the Western Hemisphere for the agency. That was because it's right on our doorstep. We have this long border, so many Mexicans coming to the United States for different reasons, and it was the critical country. And we should never forget what William Colby said also in the 70s when his book came out after he had left the CIA as director, that the largest concern, perhaps in the world, one of the most important, was Mexico and stability in Mexico. But because everyone knows that the system there is corrupt, it is unjust, and it's been going on for many, many years. And Mexico, in certain ways, is like a powder keg for the United States. Well, with the NAFTA, or the trade agreement, it's all the more important because of all the U.S. capital that's going to be flowing down there, despite the loss of jobs here. But that means capital that has to be protected. And we should never forget, you know, that old cliche that the flag follows the dollar. And where Mexico is concerned today with this free trade agreement, certainly it means that the CIA is going to be all the more active and vigilant with respect to stability in Mexico. And when I was there in the 1960s, the Mexico City CIA station was the largest one in the hemisphere. There were probably 50 people there. And I could guess that today there are probably more, and they probably have much the same agenda in Mexico as existed in the late 1960s when I was there. So all in all, Robert, I think the question of this North American Free Trade Agreement means that Mexico takes on all that much more importance, and given the amount of money that's going to be flowing there, in there from the United States through the multinational corporations, the CIA will be called upon to make sure that the situation there does not go unstable.
I have an additional anticipatory question about a Clinton administration. Without knowing precisely what names may come up, are there any things to look toward in terms of his appointments for areas such as national security, military, covert operations, intelligence appointments? Is there any kind of signpost by which we can judge?
Well, of course, each person is going to have his or her background, right? And we'll know something about their politics as they are appointed. But still, I don't think it depends so much on the individuals who will take up this job or that job, like director of the Central Intelligence Agency or the Secretary of Defense or National Security Advisor or the various people that are going to go on the National Security Council. I think that the basic objectives are going to be more or less the same. So I would watch more than the people involved where the money's going. And one of the ways to follow the money is to follow the National Endowment for Democracy, because they are supporting the same sorts of people that the CIA supports in terms of political parties, in terms of institutions of all sorts, television, radio, the media of all kinds. And that sort of information is very important to follow in all of these countries where elections are coming up, and also in the countries where the good guys get elected, like in Haiti or in Guyana, or perhaps coming up in Brazil and some other countries. So to monitor the activities and flow of money from the National Endowment for Democracy is practically to monitor what the CIA is doing, because they are like Bobbsey twins in terms of political intervention.
I wanted to take this chance to exchange greetings with a colleague. Each of us has done some work with Stuart Hutchison, who is with us now. Stuart?
Good evening, Robert.
Hello there.
Hey, Philip.
Hello there, Stuart. How are you?
It's wonderful to hear you back.
Yeah, thanks. I'm glad to be here.
And about to kick off a nationwide tour again, I expect.
Well, I've been here about 3 weeks now, and I have about three more weeks to go.
That's wonderful. Phil, Robert kindly gave me the opportunity to ask a couple of questions I thought some listeners might be interested in as well. You know, the first week of September, we had Gore Vidal on, and he was, as usual, his provocative self, and he said a couple of things that I'd like to bounce on off you. He said he couldn't understand why Clinton or Bush would want to be president, because whoever was elected, he said, would be remembered as Herbert Hoover. He went on to say that he predicts that within the next 4 years there will be a total collapse of the banking system in the United States. So I wanted to ask you, one, do you share those views? Do you think the financial system in this country is about to collapse, what with Japanese, German, and Mideast money no longer shoring up our economic system and the $4 trillion debt and all that? And secondly, do you feel yourself it's time to start a strong move across the country for a second political party?
Well, you know, I talked to Gore on the telephone from Hamburg. You know, he lives in Italy. And a couple of months ago, the last time I spoke with him, he spoke mostly about religion as opposed to economic collapse. But he has a lot of things going in that mind of his, and I can't tell you whether there might be or not be. A lot of people have been talking about a banking crisis, commercial banking crisis, on the order of the SNL crisis. I think we just have to wait and see. I don't have the information to make an informed opinion on that.
But, Stuart, I'm glad you could join us. By the way, do you have tapes of things that people might be interested in?
Oh, indeed. Everybody's always welcome to inquire at Ramshorn Productions, Box 8101. Haledon, that's H-A-L-E-D-O-N, New Jersey, 07538, and among them, of course, the famous Philip Agee on the CIA and Covert Action, A National Call-In, Dear Abby, a celebration of the words of Abby Hoffman, and many other things. Thank you for that, Robert.
Okay, I'm going to take a little voice break here and be back with all these people calling.
Thank you, Robert.
All right, Stuart Hutchison, glad you could be with us. This is Earthwatch. Robert Knight here with Phil Agee, and we'll be back with your calls at 279-3400. This is Earthwatch on WBAI in New York. My name is Robert Knight. Our guest is Philip Agee. And the phone number is 279-3400. You might want to make a note. Phil will be appearing tomorrow at a revelatory panel on covert action and the trade unions at the International Action Center. This is Earthwatch. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Robert. Someday you're going to have to play the Negative Land cover of that U2 song.
Oh, love to.
But it's been withdrawn from the market. I should dupe it somehow if I can find it, send it to you. But I had one question for Mr. Agee, and that's that I was wondering if there was ever any evidence that the CIA was involved in the eventual ouster of David Lange in New Zealand over his unilaterally declaring New Zealand a nuclear free zone, given that they were also instrumental in collapse a few years, or the destabilization a couple of years ago, the Gough Whitlam government in Australia.
I can't tell you about the Lange government in New Zealand. It's quite clear that they were involved in the overthrow of the Whitlam government in Australia. There's no question about that. But I'm not really well enough informed on New Zealand to give you an informed opinion on whether they might have been involved in the overthrow of his government.
This is Earthwatch, and you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Mexico is a powder keg, and a very significant reason why it hasn't exploded into revolution is that the corporate fascists in this country and the elites in Mexico have a policy. Well, what they want and are quite enthusiastic about is to, first of all, obliterate the border between Mexico and the U.S. That is George Bush, Reagan, and Salinas. They think that mass population transfer of Mexicans into this country is good for various reasons, but it does have the effect of staving off revolution, and I think that's not a good idea.
Do you think that's a useful hypothesis, Phil?
Well, I know that Mexican policy all along has been to maintain the border somewhat open as a kind of a escape valve or safety valve for the social pressures in Mexico. There's no doubt about that. But the United States has also cooperated since the 1960s in the maquiladora industries along the border on the Mexican side, where U.S. companies would set up shop and then the Mexicans would work in there for pittance. And we've all seen the programs on television or heard about the horrible, horrible working conditions and living conditions of the workers in those factories along the border, shanty towns and that kind of thing. Where Mexico is concerned, I think that more important is the inflow of capital to Mexico, which will create jobs in that country and therefore a bit more stability. I believe that's the kind of long-run picture that they have. And it means that the United States will in turn become more and more a third-world country like Mexico. And, for example, it was interesting to me last May Day weekend. That's when Los Angeles was burning. And I was attending an international solidarity conference in Brussels. There were about 3,000 people there from all over the world, from the Philippines, from all over Latin America, from Africa, and so forth. And as a matter of fact, it was refreshing to me because it showed that the ideal and the goal of socialism in one form or another was very much alive, despite what has happened in the world in recent years. And at one of the conferences where I spoke, someone asked me, well, why is it so difficult, or why is it difficult to sell the idea that progressive solutions are in the best interest of all the people in the United States? And I tried to give a kind of an answer, and I felt awkward. I went into a little history and talked about repression and divisions and so forth. And the man then said, well, you know, I'm from Brazil, and in 1989, our Workers' Party of Brazil just lost the elections barely. And he said, you talk about yourselves as a first world and that we're a third world. In actual fact, you have a lot of the problems that we have. And it may be that the closer you become like us, or the more that you become like us, the more people will begin to listen in the United States to your solutions to problems, your arguments. It is true that the United States is becoming very much a third world country. The third world in the United States is growing more and more. And certainly with this agreement with Mexico, that will be a spur to still more development along those lines, I think.
Mm. That would necessitate unusual and severe means of maintaining civil order at some point, wouldn't it?
Well, we just saw in Los Angeles, didn't we? And to me, Los Angeles was, they also questioned me about that there in Brussels. It was happening right then. Everyone was watching it on television. And I said, look, that's the system operating exactly the way it's supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
I said, not that this type of violence should break out, but momentarily the ruling class, let's say, or those who do rule the United States, were unable to keep the lid on. But the anxiety, the hatred, the frustration, and so forth has always been there. And that is the system working the way it is supposed to, because we have a system where there's always going to be a so-called underclass, always has been, and it's growing all the time.
This is Earth Watch. You're on the air.
Hello?
Hello?
Oh, hi. Gotcha. I'd like...
No, we got you.
I'd like to... Yeah, I'm just turned off the set so I can hear you better. I'd like you to comment on the fact that our president-elect is also a member of the Trilateral Commission, as were our past presidents, vice presidents, and their secretaries of state, and what that might bode for us and for the New World Order.
Mm, good question.
Well, I wish Holly Sklar was here to take
yes.
that question, because she
She's
is
the author of Trilateralism.
That's right. She's the expert. But I would simply say that, as we all know, trilateralism means the cooperation and development of capitalism among the developed countries in Asia, mainly Japan, in the United States and Canada, and Western Europe. That is, that they will be meeting, they will be seeking solutions to all the problems, and they will be seeking ever greater prosperity for themselves. That is, the elites which rule these countries. I think with Clinton, there's going to certainly be a continuation of this. Jimmy Carter's administration, I think, had more trilateral people in it than anybody else. And it may be that Clinton will bring a lot of those people in. But the truth of the matter is that trilateralism is very much alive. And we can look forward to seeing the antecedents or the backgrounds of various Clinton appointees in the trilateral movement.
I'll tell you where I'm keeping my eyes peeled, Phil, and that's with the Ozone Man. And I'm watching very carefully for the environmental policies. Let me first say that I wondered if I were alone in finding it horribly, almost comically obscene, for George Bush to be referring to Al Gore as Mr. Ozone, when it was George Bush in the deregulatory process of the Reagan years, where he helped put a stake through auto emission standards, which required a simple small step up to an efficiency of about 30 miles per gallon. And the amount of gasoline that was wasted by thwarting that law was equal to the amount that was brought in from Kuwait on the eve of the what would eventually become the Gulf War after the Iraqi takeover and then the ensuing war. And so the contributions to ozone depletion that George Bush himself is personally involved in, to be ridiculing a concern about that, I thought was obscene. However, I say that I'm also looking very skeptically at Al Gore for traces of trilateralism in this new, almost corporate environmental consciousness. One of the things, a recent trilateral study, Beyond Interdependence, puts forward strongly the trilateral thesis, that we shouldn't look at this environment thing simplistically and should rather look for economic global bargains
in regard to the environment, which means yet another lever of maintaining the same kind of third world, International Monetary Fund, World Bank, local depletion policies going, as well as the debt repayments. So I'm a little cautious skeptical.
Well, also we have to take into consideration that they are quite aware of the ecological problem. I'm talking about the people who are running the multinational corporations and those who are serving them in government, wherever that happens to be. They know that their system cannot continue when the environment is destroyed. And so if they're enlightened, certainly they will try to... It's in their self-interest, their own survival, to take measures. But at the same time, they have to weigh the profit motive against the ecological factor. And, of course, we're going to be seeing that in the years ahead.
This is Earthwatch, and you're on the air.
Hi. With Mr. Agee's experience in the concept, I assume he's familiar with the concept of low-intensity warfare.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. I've been, you know, knocking around ideas over the past couple of years in reference to this drug war policy this government pulls out. And it seems to me that this is a policy of low-intensity warfare aimed primarily at inner-city populations, you know. Not trying to sound like a conspiratorial, you know, thinker. The confluence of drug input, arms input, social degeneration, and also social stereotyping, isolation, would seem to me to point out some sort of policy in this direction. If you can comment on that, you know, I'd appreciate it.
Well, my comment would be in terms of this domestic drug problem, is this, that through the drug culture, a whole generation of young people are being taken out of the political process year by year. And these are young people who have everything to gain by change in the United States. I'm talking about ghetto youth above all. And when they get onto drugs in terms of consumption or in the commerce involved, then they are not political activists. They are taken out of that political process, and they are the people who ought to be out in the streets demonstrating and fighting for political change in the United States, that so that they and their neighbors and their brothers and sisters and so forth have a chance. But the effect of the drug culture is that these people are removed from the political struggle. I don't say that that's a conspiracy either. I agree with you. I think it's a matter of fact, but not that it's especially planned that way. I mean, after all, when you consider all the military force the United States has, all the Coast Guard, all the Navy, all the police, FBI, and all the rest, it seems that the conclusion would be that drugs could be kept out of the United States if there was a desire to do so. And one more thing I would just add is that I don't have the figures exactly, but the military effort that is going into the anti-drug war abroad, like in Peru and in Colombia and supposedly Panama and the coasts and so forth, has increased enormously. I mean, it's almost boggling when you read the figures on what the increase has been in just the military side or the militarization of the war against drugs in terms of going after the source of the drugs. And this, in turn, focuses on countries that have a considerable insurgency problem, like this low-intensity conflict you're talking about, like in Peru with Shining Path and in Colombia with the various organizations there. So, in a way, in a very significant way, the anti-drug war is being used really as a counterinsurgency or low-intensity conflict way to get at the insurgents as opposed to the actual drug trade.
As with any war, I suppose one principle has been it's just as useful to produce casualties. You don't have to kill the opposing soldiers as long as you tie down the society in caretaking those who have been wounded.
Of course. Yes.
This is Earthwatch. You're on the air. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, Robert.
Yes.
Turn down my radio for a moment. I haven't spoken to you, I haven't heard you actually since the spring, when you had a very interesting program with defending Sister Soldier and the things that she was saying and singing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can probably still find an October Spin somewhere. It's in print there.
And you were kind of, kind of upset, I guess that's my, with Miss Clinton. Like Clinton at the time.
What?
I wonder if from between then and now, how you feel about him.
I feel great about the election. I feel the same about Bill Clinton. I feel that he squandered some moral capital with his great lead during this campaign to not rectify the racial xenophobia with which he launched his campaign, the studied and deliberate distance from the underclass, from the colored, from the black, who you never saw until after the third incarnation of those damn bus rides. And, of course, the Sister Soldier incident was what I considered a rational act of plagiarism to eclipse the announcement of the Rainbow Coalition's economic plan for rebuilding America. It wouldn't be until several days later that Clinton and his people would be able to come up with a coherent release that they said was their economic program. So I say that a bus that puts some people in the back is not really a change and is, in fact, a very Southern tradition. And so he has yet to convince through his deeds me that he was wrong in that way. About the election, I'm happy because George Bush killed some of my friends in Panama, and because I could not countenance more of what he has represented for more than a decade of somnambulism in America. I was also very glad to have the opportunity for the first time in recent elections of the one-party system, as Stewart alluded to be countably divergent. That is my phrase for the election season, to be countably divergent, that there was an independent candidacy that was spearheaded by Ross Perot, who indeed is a the first temperamental choice one might choose for president, but his candidacy represented a way to get rid of a worse president, elect one who has not proven himself to be as bad yet, and at the same time reprogram the candidates of 96 by letting them know that there's a great big block of people who, for various reasons, not all the same reason necessarily, are discontent, and that the next approach will have to be more intelligent. That's how I feel about that. This is Earthwatch, though. Oh, yeah. Phil.
I just add here, it's slightly relevant to the question, and that is that we should all study, we should all take interest in and help to support the alternative military budget that was presented earlier this year by the Black Caucus, Progressive Caucus in the House of Representatives. These are people like John Conyers, like Bernie Sanders, and so forth. And it happens that in March, this proposed military budget received a full day's debate in the House of Representatives and received 77 votes, which was far more than Bush's military budget received at the time. This calls for a 50% reduction in the military budget over 4 years, I believe it is, as opposed to what both Clinton and Bush have proposed, which is a marginal reduction, even though the Soviet Union has disappeared. I think Bush was calling for $1.42 trillion over 5 years, and Clinton was calling for $1.36 trillion, which is just $60 billion less over 5 years, which is not very much less than Bush was requesting. But the Congressional Black Caucus and Progressive Caucus have introduced another bill, and they will do it again, I'm sure, in the coming spring. And we all ought to be trying as hard as we can to get them support so that everybody knows that there is an alternative. And that is one of the things that was hardly discussed at all in the presidential campaign, was how much should we reduce, and why should we keep it as high as it is, and why shouldn't we be reallocating all of these funds to training people, to getting schools and so forth going in the inner cities, you know? I mean, adult education, for giving people the skills they need to have jobs.
Phil, I'm afraid that's going to turn very mean. I'm watching the rhetoric already on the TV network morning programs where they have gaggles of whites interrogating punitively Jesse Jackson, saying, "Well, Mr. Jackson, are you going to come out for workfare or not? I mean, we've got this welfare mess. Do you support workfare?" And he says, well, it's a complicated question. It's about the closing of the plants, and there's going to be more welfare when that happens. And they said, but what about workfare? And I fear that there's going to be sort of a very brutal analysis of the plight of those dispossessed by the policies.
Yeah, but, you know, already a lot of very good work has been done by people like Seymour Melman and others, you know, on reconversion of the economy to peaceful purposes.
Well,
and we have the opportunity now, the first big opportunity right now since 1950,
okay,
to reorder the priorities, because the Soviet threat is no more an excuse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's one of the reasons, I think, why Bush took us into the Persian Gulf War, you know, to have a substitute for the Soviet Union, foreign threat, keep the military budget up, permanent war economy and so forth. But in actual fact, we do have this opportunity. We all have to understand it and get behind those people who are in Congress fighting for, let's say, reconversion and for the reduction, a proper reduction of the military budget.
This is Earthwatch. You're on the air.
Hello. Oh, yes, want to thank you for having Mr. Agee as your guest. I've heard him before, and it's always a really educational experience in the best sense of the word. I hardly know where to be. I'd just like to ask one thing, Mr. Agee, if I might. It may sound extremely naive, but it seems that... the impression that we get is that the CIA, your former employer, that they seem to do anything that they have a mind to, you know, in any place in the world, practically. And my question is this, as I say, it's very naive, but it seems to me that wouldn't you say part of their success is just plain buying up all the bad people, to put it in one word, that they could find? But I'm just saying, they use the economic might of the United States, our money, you know, our wealth that we want to do good with, and they take it and send it to the other side of the world.
Let's hear what Phil thinks about that.
Yes, please.
Well, you know, CIA secret intervention has been seen for many, many years as a third way. That is, a third way between, on the one hand, polite, correct diplomacy, which is carried on by ambassadors and State Department people, with a host government, wherever it happens to be in the world, and outright military force to achieve U.S. foreign policy.
I'm your masters of war. You that build the big guns. You that build the death planes. You that build all the bombs. You that hide behind walls. You that hide behind disks. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me to believe, but I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my drain. You fasten all the triggers for the others to fire. And then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion while the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud. You've thrown the worst fear that can ever be hurled. Fear to bring children into the world. A voice threatening my baby, unborn and unnamed. You ain't worth the blood that runs in your veins. How much do I know? But to talk out of turn, you might say that I'm young, you might say I'm unlearned, but there's the one thing I know, I'm younger than you, that even Jesus would never forgive what you do. Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Or will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could? I think you will find when your death takes its toll, all the money you made will never buy back your soul. And I hope that you die, and your death will come soon. I'll follow your casket by the pale afternoon. I'll watch while you lord down to your deathbed, and I stand over your grave till I'm sure that you're dead. Sisters,
This commemorative version of Earthwatch was produced by Catherine Davis and Paulette Spencer. The concluding songs were Bob Dylan, Masters of War, Labri Soufri, Something Inside So Strong, and John Lennon, Gimme Some Truth.
Well, Catherine and all, we ended about a minute early, it would seem, catching me, I won't say with my pants down, that would not bode well, but catching me slightly unawares, but what else is new, Jim being unawares. But I will tell you that this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. And, oh, like 30 seconds more to fill. I can't... the fun drive is over for this week. You know, there'll probably be another one like in a month or something like that. So I can't pitch. Oh, I know what to say. Pay your pledges. That's it. If you called to support WBAI, to keep, you know, listener-sponsored radio alive and broadcasting, and we hope that you all did, then pay your pledge. Or we'll have to howl. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a non-marathon, fun drive, non-memorial edition, although we've lost people again. But not personal friends for a change. At any rate, this is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Our guest this morning, Sam J. Miller. And of course, we're going to find out from Dan Persons, is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles worth a dime? Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Let me begin my discussion of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles by describing a moment from Guardians of the Galaxy. Sometime past the halfway point, one of the members of the Bad Guys Reluctantly Doing Good Stuff team, Rocket, a CG animated raccoon, delivers a brief monologue where he expresses his anger and frustration at the treatment he's received at the hands of the other characters. It's a surprisingly effective moment, using a combination of believable CG animation, good voice work by Bradley Cooper, and some nice writing by director and writer James Gunn and his partner Nicole Perlman to bring depth and credibility to this little character. Towards the end of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, one of the CG animated turtles, I don't know which one, I don't care, delivers a speech as the team faces certain death about how much he loves and admires his brothers. It goes on and serves only as an obvious setup for a very predictable punchline, one made worse by the fact that the gag is pretty much bungled by director Jonathan Liebesman. And that's the way it goes for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. The film has been poorly served by being released following Guardians of the Galaxy. Not that opinions of it would be any better had it hit the screens at some other time. It'd always be a mediocre film. It's just that coming out in close proximity to Guardians casts Turtles' deficiencies in sharp relief. Basically, both films are the same in their humble intent. Provide a couple of hours of action-packed entertainment, nothing more, nothing less. It's just that whatever Turtles tries, Guardians has done smarter, wittier, and more creatively. I'm wondering if part of the reason for that is that Guardians director James Gunn is also its co-writer, and a pretty good one at that. He has the confidence to connect the film's action mandate with his own skills in sculpting character and bringing a unique outlook to a very standard Find the MacGuffin plot. Turtles director Liebesman was responsible for the similarly disposable Wrath of the Titans and the actually not too bad Battle Los Angeles, but here turns writing duties over to other people and is working in the Michael Bay feature factory and all of the characteristics of the Bay brand of filmmaking attach: the pointless, vertiginous camera moves, the nearly incomprehensible action sequences, CG character animation that's at once elaborate and not particularly pleasurable to watch, and an approach to storytelling that downplays the need for any kind of writing that might rise above the cliche. Amazingly, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles has even less of a plot than Guardians of the Galaxy. Its title almost is the plot, and its characters aren't anything to talk about. There are differentiations to the turtles, but they don't really stick. And as for the human players, Megan Fox brings the same commitment and credibility to her role as video journalist April O'Neil as she did to her role as an auto enthusiast in the Transformers films, while Will Arnett and William Fichtner do what they usually do, which is at least something. There's nothing horrendously bad about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. It's just more pap out of the Michael Bay supposed to be fun factory. If you've already seen Guardians of the Galaxy and need another summertime action fix, why don't you see Guardians of the Galaxy again? I'm not rushing back for a second viewing myself, but I've no doubt that if I went in for another go, it would still deliver more entertainment and surprises than my first viewing of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at the CineFantastique online website. Catch up on what you missed by going to cfqonline.com.
Thank you, Dan. That was a worthy review. I'm so pleased you didn't like it. I was just telling our guest, Sam J. Miller, and I didn't finish the story off here, so I'll finish it on air, as catharsis after learning of the death of another beloved BAI person, Steve Post, my partner Barbara and I went to see Guardians of the Galaxy, which, by the way, rocks. I mean, we just loved it. And, by the way, you must stay for the end post-credit.
We always do.
Yeah.
We always do.
But this one is not Samuel Jackson.
Okay.
it is a total spoiler.
Great.
To say what it is. It's just this one may be the best of them all for its obscurity and wonderment and the willingness to delve into the more obscure corners of the Marvel world.
Sounds fascinating.
Well, if you're reading the comics in the era, I never read Guardians of the Galaxy, but there were other comics at that same time, and this involves one of them. At any rate, we went to see Guardians of the Galaxy as catharsis for all these people, beloved people dying. And by the way, it worked. Really, really mood-altering, uplifting.
Great.
All of that stuff. But the thing that gave us pause is going into the theater and the person at the ticket booth saying, "Are you a senior?"
Aww.
Wait, that's not the bad part. The bad part is, okay, I just turned 60. It turned out that I am. And given the prices, we got in for a mere $17 instead of like $25.
Yeah.
But both Barbara and I got in as seniors right when we're mourning a close friend who was 67 and another who was 70. Steve Post was 70. And before that, this woman, Carolyn Fireside, who is not well known, but she worked at NAL. She helped launch the careers of Terry Bisson and...